asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. The Afghan government says there will be a temporary ceasefire with the Taliban to coincide with Eid at the end of the month of Ramadan. It follows denials last week from the Taliban that it was in secret talks with Afghanistan's government. The ceasefire, if confirmed, is due to come into effect next week, although Afghan forces will continue to fight against other militant groups in the country. Spain's King Felipe VI has sworn in a new socialist government. A record 11 women have been named in 17 cabinet posts by the new Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. UK Prime Minister Theresa May and Brexit Secretary David Davis have reached an agreement on a backstop plan to propose to the EU. He was reportedly considering resigning over the issue unless a desired end date was included. India is likely to be the world's fastest growing major economy for the next 3 years, according to the World Bank. It's forecasting growth of 7.3% this year in India. Our correspondent Rebecca Bunden reports from Mumbai.
The World Bank expects economic growth of 7.3% to be followed by a pickup to 7.5% next year and the following year. Data from the Indian government this month showed that India's economy gathered pace in the January to March quarter, with GDP growth of 7.7%. This is the highest level since the government's controversial demonetization move in November 2016 and the introduction of a new goods and services tax last year, which dampened growth. Rebecca Bunden, Mumbai.
Maldives has asked New Delhi to explain why a leader of the country's ruling party was not allowed to enter India earlier this week. This comes as ties between India and the Maldives have been strained over Malé's growing proximity to China and post-India's criticism of the state of emergency imposed in the Maldives earlier this year. Nihir Punia reports from New Delhi.
Ahmed Nihan, a senior member of the ruling party of Maldives, claims he was denied entry by Indian officials when he landed in the city of Chennai for medical consultation. He claims he was detained for 4 hours by the immigration authorities despite having a diplomatic passport and a valid visa. Immigration authorities have refused to comment, but officials say that his name may have been on a list of high-ranking people under the category of banned for entry.
British nightclub owner Peter Stringfellow has died at the age of 77. The businessman became famous for his eponymous London night spot. He also hosted music legends, including the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix, during more than 60 years in the entertainment industry, as Paul Barber reports from London.
He was known as the King of Clubs. Peter Stringfellow was the son of a Yorkshire steelworker and began his career putting on music nights in his home city of Sheffield. He rose to fame in the 1980s with the establishment of the Stringfellows Club in Covent Garden in London's West End. It became a hotspot for international celebrities, and Stringfellow went on to launch clubs in Paris, New York, Miami and Beverly Hills.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks, Ollie. Thank you. Good stuff. Welcome to Thursday's programme. Hope you're well wherever you are. And you've had a good day. It's another scorcher. It's another scorcher in Manchester. What's going on? Somebody's turned on the machine. Well, a few weeks ago and left it on. It's that weather-changing machine. It's glorious. Tweet me between now and the end of the show, at Richie Allen Show is the Twitter handle. Got a couple of top guests lined up for you today. Look forward to hearing from you during the course of the programme as well. Welcome to Thursday's programme.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Right, this hour I'll be joined by a very old friend of mine who's not been on this programme for nearly 2 years. John Perkins, humanitarian, activist, shaman, author, former World Bank advisor, the man who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, one of, if not the most important books I've ever read in my life. He's done lots more as well. Great to catch up with John. The timing is perfect, of course. John Perkins this hour. And in the second hour of the programme, regular visitor to this show, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, former US Assistant Treasury Secretary, will join us live from Virginia. PCR, Paul Craig Roberts, top man, joins us in the second hour. So a busy old show Thursday. And I'll remind you, I will be with you tomorrow at 4 p.m. UK time live as well. I'm going to say that now and several times this evening so that you don't forget. 4 o'clock live tomorrow, but if you miss that, don't worry. It will be repeated at 7 p.m. tomorrow evening, Friday. That's just to make up for my trip to Old Trafford on Tuesday. Right. Okay, I'll mention that again later on, in case you forget. All right. Let's start off with a bit of Brexit. Stop! Don't groan. Don't whinge. Don't complain. Shut your cake hole and stay there. I say that in jest, of course. I know it's driving people up the wazoo. But we've got to talk about it. I'm trying not to talk about it too much. And I'm trying to inject a little bit of humour as best as I can, though there's nothing funny about it. I got an email today from somebody who's been listening to me for too long. From a woman who listens to the programme in Sri Lanka. This is true. And she asked me in the email to explain this backstop bollocks. And those were her words. That's the term. Monumental bollocks now introduced into the lexicon of Sri Lankans. What's this backstop bollocks, Richie? The EU. Because the media seem to be making a complete lirodi of explaining it. Lirodi is the Irish word for balls. The media is making a balls of explaining it in a way that you can understand it. Not you, but some people. So what is the customs backstop issue? Right, well, we voted to leave the European Union. Not that that matters, really, anymore. That included leaving the customs union, of course. What is the customs union? Well, it allows one country within the EU to trade with another without any border checks or without any taxes, any tariffs. So, the government, that's the UK government, and EU negotiators like Michel Barnier, they haven't yet agreed how this will all work after the UK leaves the European Union. They haven't agreed on how trade in goods will continue. But they said that a backstop option is necessary just in case there is a no deal. Or the technology is not ready in time to avoid the return of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Now, this is absolute monumental bollocks. This hard border shite. This is an invention. This is the figment of the imaginations of those who want to thwart the will of the people. So, what did the UK say? Well, weeks and weeks and weeks ago, the UK said that they thoroughly rejected the European Union's plan to deal with all of this, because the EU said, well, let's just keep Northern Ireland, that's Northern Ireland, in the customs union. But the UK said, no, piss off, because that would create a border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. Right, so what did the UK propose? Well, the UK proposed a backup plan, which would mean that the whole of the UK would basically stay in the customs union after December 2020, which is when the 21-month transition period ends. But a lot of people didn't like that. Brexiteers were none too happy. Why should we keep the whole of the UK in the customs union after the transition period for an indeterminate or an indefinite period of time? Why should we do that? That's tantamount to staying in, right? Right. So David Davis, the Brexit secretary, he lost his shit and said, no, not having that. Jacob Rees-Mogg, terminological inexactitude, darling, lost his shit. Others lost their collective excrement. They didn't like it. So Davis was furious and he demanded that if there is to be some sort of alignment after the transition period, there has to be an end date in it. So the end date has been put in the government's proposed backstop plan and the end date will be the end of 2021. Right? I can't make it any simpler than that. So, if the European Union goes for this, and they won't because they're a shower of bastards, it means that the UK won't be leaving the European Union for, well, until at least 2021. That'd be December 31st, 2021, my birthday. It ain't happening. Do you get the picture? Conservative MP Peter Bone is absolutely doolally about this. He has lost, like a lot of pro-Brexit, pro-leave people, he's properly furious. This is Peter Bone, MP, speaking with Sky News today. Have a listen.
No, it's not binding. You make a very good point. It was interesting the Labour Party's position now is they want to stay in the EU. And not only do they want to stay in by virtue of what they're proposing, but they now want a second referendum on it. That's amazing. Labour's split down the middle. But in relation to this backstop thing, it's totally unnecessary. And in my view, we need to have someone who's driving the Brexit policy who absolutely believes in it. And that's the only chance. But I think we've probably got the time now.
To go, Peter.
Probably we've got to a stage now where we say a deal on world trade rules is much better than anything we could possibly get. And it may be the time just to say, we're not negotiating with you anymore. You've been an impossible organisation to negotiate with. We're going to come out at the end of March next year, save £39 billion, regain our own fishing rights, have our own immigration policy, make our own trade deals, and make our own laws in our own country, judged by our own judges. That's what the people voted for in the referendum. And why is it so many politicians now are trying to stop that happening?
Because they are beholden to Rothschild Zionist agents operating in this country. There's no such thing as democracy. Your politicians do not work for you. They never have done. Ever. Look at Jezza Corbyn, wrote about him today. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard had a fantastic piece in the Telegraph newspaper today about how it's over. But we've been saying that it's over for a long time. This is like the cockroach lying on its back that can't right itself, kicking its legs in the air. Brexit is dead. It was never alive to begin with. What do you have waiting in the wings? You have Jezza the liar. Corbyn the con man. We want to stay in the single market and the customs union. Which is what he's saying now. Months ago he was saying, no, we've got to abide by the will of the people and we have to leave the single market. We should stay in some sort of customs union, but we have to leave the single market. Now he's saying we should stay in the single market, and he won't rule out putting forward another referendum should Labour win the next election. This is a man who spent all his life railing against the tyranny of the fascist dictatorship EU. So you have no choice, effectively. There is none. UKIP are gone, destroyed, finished, and in their wake, nothing. Right? Right. That's the way it is. Peter Bone there today. Vladimir Putin had his annual phone-in today. Now, state television broadcasts this. It's an interesting thing to a point. Putin goes on telly and people can phone in and ask him questions about the state of the country, about his policies and about plans that he has for the future and all the rest of it. Sky's Moscow correspondent Diana Magne was there to observe this, and she sent this report back to Sky, and she basically talks here about the things that Putin said today in this phone-in show. Pretty biased. Have a listen. This is Diana Magne, Sky News.
This is his annual direct call session. It's called a Q&A session, where essentially he allows people to call up and have their say, make people feel that they have some kind of involvement in the political process. And I think one pensioner put it very well, saying, why is it that the only way I can get answers to my problems is by calling your Q&A session? And he did cover a lot of ground, talking about relations with the West, saying that sanctions sanctions and containment strategies are counterproductive, that, as you say, the US has upset strategic balance, and that people need to sit down and work together to try and establish a European security architecture, which he clearly seems to want to be a part of. He did refer to the Skripals, but essentially saying what he said before on that case, that if this had been a military-grade nerve agent, then plenty more people would have died. This is something he's said over and over again, and that he wants to have a part of the investigation and for Russia to have access to the investigation. In regards Syria and Ukraine, he also made comments. He said twice before that Russia would pull out its troops from Syria. Now he says that troops will stay there as long as it is in Russia's interests. And he warned Ukraine not to stage any kind of provocations, he said, or military uptick in the Donbass region during the World Cup. So quite a lot of ground covered. One more quite interesting thing that I think will interest English viewers is comments on Roman Abramovich. He said that essentially Russian businessmen were being persecuted abroad and encouraged Russia's billionaires to bring their money back home. And one last thing I'd like to point out, he said that he was asked at one stage, how do you feel, what was the one piece of advice that your father gave to you? And without missing a beat, he went, do not lie. Now, I think that there are plenty in the West who would look at the Kremlin's record on, for example, whether there were Russian troops in Crimea, whether there was Russian involvement in MH17, whether there was Russian election interference in the 2016 US election, et cetera, as suggesting perhaps the Kremlin per se has not taken Mr. Putin's senior advice on board.
Yeah, typical Rupert Murdoch journalist report there. Load of nonsense. There's no proof. There isn't a shred of evidence that the Russian government has tried to interfere in the general elections of Europe, in the referendum here in 2016 or in the US election. No proof has been offered ever. And there's no proof, not even a whiff of it, that the FDB, on the orders of the Kremlin, had anything to do with the attempt on the life of Sergei Skripal and his daughter. Even if you believe that somebody attempted to kill Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal, because all the evidence points to the opposite being true, that nobody's attempted to kill them, right? Bizarre stuff. I suppose Bashar al-Assad would have watched that phone-in with interest, and he would have been happy to hear the Russian president reaffirm Russia's commitment to staying the course in Syria and offering the Syrian government the support it needs in its efforts to rid the country of the Western-backed, head-chopping lunatics that are on the run in that country. Good stuff. Here's one that'll make you laugh. 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The Richie Allen Show for Thursday. This'll make you giggle. Fair play to Polly Boyko, RT reporter. Like Polly a lot. Very good reporter. Peers in the House of Lords have been told to stop sleeping on the job and refrain even from sedentary shouting, along with other transgressions that have been observed in recent months, according to a memo from the Chief Whip. Lord Taylor of Holbeach warned Tory peers in an email that no more bad behaviour would be tolerated, claiming, quote, it has been observed by members of our House that over recent months, conduct in the chamber has not been of the standard we should expect. End quote. And a list of primary misdemeanours committed by Tory peers was included in this memo, including things like audible conversations, shouting, as well as the common offence of falling asleep in the chamber. Right. Yes. This is unelected fuckers who seek to subvert the referendum result. These are the people who defeated the withdrawal bill, the EU withdrawal bill, on 15 different aspects of it, and who will continue to try and do that next week. These unelected, appointed bastards who get £300 a day to do what? I'll tell you to do what. To get pissed in the many bars that festoon the halls of Westminster. They get pissed and then they waddle into the chamber and they snore and fart their way through the afternoon until they get a text message from Jeeves, and Jeeves tells them that the Rolls Royce is outside the front door. They then struggle to their feet, waddle to the Rolls Royce, fuck off to do God knows what, and then they return the following day to fart and snore their way through the day again, in between getting pissed, subverting a bit of democracy here and there, and then going back to the car where Jeeves will take them home again. And the beat goes on. Don't you just love democracy? Now, Vivian Westwood is a fashion impresario. You know Vivian Westwood, outspoken fashionista. She's going to break Julian Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy. That's what she said anyway when speaking to Ortiz Going Underground. She might have had a few sherbets in her herself. Right. This is Vivian Westwood speaking to Afshin Ratanzi, I think that's his name, who presents Going Underground. She's going to break out Assange.
I've come up with the term that is really flouting public justice throughout the world, and it's called misrule of law. And it's the British government who practice misrule of law. They have no legal reason whatsoever to keep him there. There's nothing that he's done that they can keep him there with. They keep inventing things just for the sake of keeping him there. Why? This is all to do with America. Because I think Britain would actually like to say to Julian, okay, you can step outside that door. We have nothing to arrest you for. Please, you can go. But if they do that, then they've got the trouble that America want him extradited, and they don't want to deal with that. You know, they don't want to say, oh, America, you're our best friend, but we don't want to extradite him. Do you mind? No, they don't want to do that. They don't want to be in that position. You know, so I think that's what's going on. And I'm going to get him out of there with this misrule of law. I fought the law means I fought misrule of law. And I fought the law and I helped get Julian Assange out of there. I'm going to give free T-shirts away. I'm going to get a pop group to start singing I fought the law. They already did. You know, public opinion's got to be against misrule of law.
Go on, Vivian. She's had a few sherbets. Somebody nominate her for a peerage. She'll fit right in. This is Thursday's Richie Allen Show. 22 minutes past the hour. Here's a quick break. When we come back, John Perkins joins us live. He's just checked in. That's good. Back in two.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Ah, tis lovely. Tis lovely in South Manchester. John Perkins is next. Here's the Beach Boys.
There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you wanna go to get away from it all. Bodies in the sand, tropical kick melting in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of a steel drum band down in Kokomo.
Music from the Beach Boys, Kokomo on your Richie Allen Show, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Tune in radio, triggerwarning.tv and richieallen.co.uk. Shouldn't have mentioned the weather. Reports coming in from all across the country and across Europe. It's glorious, absolutely glorious weather we're having. Do you know, it's terrific to be welcoming back my first guest to this programme. I did say at the beginning of the programme, and I meant it, that Confessions of an Economic Hitman is one of, if not the most important books that I've ever read. Now, in it, my guest described how he helped to bribe and threaten the heads of state of countries around the world in order to create a global empire. And if those leaders didn't cooperate, they were assassinated or overthrown. It's a very important book. It's as relevant today as it was when he wrote it. He's a former chief economist, even at a major international consulting firm. He advised the World Bank, the UN, the IMF, Fortune 500 corporations and the Treasury Department in the US. And his best-selling books include the aforementioned Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years, and also The Secret History of the American Empire, Hoodwinked, and the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Top man, it's been nearly 2 years, or even over 2 years, since we last saw him. Let's welcome back our friend John Perkins. By the way, check him out at John. His website is johnperkins.org. John, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, Richie. Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
It's been ages, and it's great to be with you too. And when I announced yesterday that you were coming back, I was inundated with messages of goodwill for you. And there are many of them, and you can see them on Twitter and on our website as well. It's marvellous to see that. Thanks for doing it. We won't dwell on this because I know you're tired of asking this question, but because this show goes out on commercial radio and we have a lot of listeners who are new to this information, do you want to briefly remind us what an economic hitman is, and importantly, are these people operating today in 2018?
Well, let me start by saying they certainly are still operating. It's bigger and more nefarious than ever. That's why I wrote the follow-up to the old Confessions, which was 2004. So about a year ago, I came out with the new Confessions, which really updates. And it says that, you know, what we used to do, what I did as an economic hitman in developing countries, now has come back to strike Europe, the British Isles, the United States, what we call the developed countries. So what I did in my day was to, I had a staff of close to 50 people, at different times up to 50 people. My job was to identify countries with resources that corporations wanted, like oil, primarily what we call third world countries, and arrange huge loans to those countries from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money didn't go to the country. It went to our own corporations to build infrastructure projects in those, in that country, things like power plants and industrial parks that benefited our companies, the ones that built these projects, made huge profits off them, and a few wealthy families in those countries who own the commercial establishments, the banks, the ones, the industries, the ones who could use this infrastructure, but left most of the country holding a huge debt. So it really hurt the average citizen and the poor people, because money was diverted from health care and education and other social services to pay off the interest on the loan. And in the end, the loans were never repaid, the principal. So then we'd go back in and say, hey, sell your oil or whatever the resource was real cheap to our corporations without any environmental or social regulations. Privatize your water and sewage systems, your electric utilities, your jails, your schools, sell them to our investors. Let us build a military base on your soil, these sorts of things. And when the governments of these countries would not accept the game that we were playing, the deals that I offered, then people called jackals would go in and either assassinate the leaders or overthrow them in coups. And that's really the system that I was under. Now, in more recent years, it's come back that every major corporation now has its equivalent of economic hitmen who go out and try to arrange good tax deals in various countries, pit countries against each other for better tax deals, for better labor wages, and less environmental restrictions, and so on and so forth. And as you well know, individuals in Europe and in the British Isles and in the United States are hit by increasing amounts of debt for education, health care, all credit card debt. When you know, so it's that same kind of system that enslaves people in debt. And when people are enslaved in debt, they don't take actions to make the changes that we really must see in the world today.
Yeah, and I got to mention again, if people haven't read Confessions or the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, check them out. It is one of those books, John. I've said it for years, even before I first spoke with you back in 2009. It's in no way to downplay the importance of the book. It's about the best entry-level read you can give to somebody who really hasn't a clue what's going on. I can't pay it any higher compliment than that. It really is. Go to johnperkins.org, folks. So the way they do it has changed a bit, John. I always put out to our listeners, when someone like yourself is coming on, send us a few questions for John. A lot of people are talking about the European Union and how countries are desperately trying to get out of it, or at least the peoples of those countries like Italy, Greece, of course, we've seen tried and failed, and other countries trying to get out of it. And a lot of people are saying, well, surely the European Union, one of the reasons it was set up was to do that very thing you described so eloquently a few minutes ago, which was basically to become a kind of an asset grab for all the really important, the real wealth of all the countries of Europe. You see it like that as well, I'm guessing.
Well, certainly I do. And you know, particularly the idea of having one currency throughout Europe really played in the hands of big corporations. That made life much easier. The relaxing of borders, the fact that you can move people and goods and services across borders much more easily, that helped these big corporations. However, I also think that the big corporations recently have been a little afraid. I think they're part of what's – I think there's always a story behind the story, Richie. You know, and I think that they were beginning to see that the European Union was coming together to come across with more unified and fairer social laws, employment laws, environmental laws. So the big corporations prefer that there be some countries where labor is really cheap and other countries where environmental restrictions are very loose, very lax. And I think the European Union was beginning to move in a direction that scared some big corporations, that they were going to have leveled the playing field across countries. So there may be a story behind the story here where corporations, they want to have one currency, and they want to have lax borders that they can move goods and services and people across, but they don't want to have a systemic series of laws and regulations that create more social justice and environmental restrictions across the board.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this, because the UK electorate voted to leave in 2016. We've seen anti-European Union governments come in Spain, obviously, most recently in Spain, very recently Italy. People have had enough of it. They've had enough of low wages. They've had enough of the sorts of corruption that you've talked about for years and years and years. But there are certainly more aspects to it. A question I was asked... Go ahead, John, jump in.
Well, Well, yeah. So in these austerity programs that have been implemented in so many of these countries are, you know, that's typical of what the World Bank does. That's typical. You know, you don't make the corporations pay. You don't make the wealthy people pay. You make the average citizen or the poorer people pay. And we're seeing a tremendous rebellion against that in many parts of Europe, and we're also seeing it in Latin America and other countries. So there's people are beginning to wake up to the fact that these programs are there just to benefit the wealthy and take a greater toll on the middle class and the poor.
I was asked to put to you as well. I don't know, you know, how much you've looked into to this character, but a name that's come up a lot in the last few years. A number of people, really, billionaire philanthropists, or at least they want to be seen as philanthropists, but they're using their money to influence, uprisings, coups, whatever it be, in certain parts of the world. We're hearing a lot of it, people like George Soros. It's interesting, John, that the Russian president, I know you met the Russian president last year or the year before, you're in Russia. People can read about that at johnperkins.org. Really interested in that too, John. But Vladimir Putin was talking to Austrian television, I think the day before yesterday, and brought up, you know, how guys like Soros are being used or are trying to influence things in countries and create instability. And I was wondering, is that one of these new ways that they're creating the sort of instability that you wrote about in Confessions? What do you think? People like George Soros.
Yeah, we have a whole lot of these types of people. Well, I say a whole lot. They're a very small part of the global population, but very powerful. You know, we know that there's 8 individuals that have as much wealth as half the world's population today. And yes, they exercise huge amounts of authority over these countries and over people. It's destruction of democracy. In the United States, democracy has been totally turned on its head by the wealthy. There's no question that our idea of one person, one vote no longer holds in the United States. The wealthy people have thousands of votes. They're the equivalent of that. They don't actually get the votes, but they get to choose who the candidates are that we vote for through campaign financing, by offering politicians extremely lucrative consulting jobs and advisory jobs if they decide not to run or if they lose an election. There's all kinds of bribes that are going on, and a lot of them are theoretically, they're legal under the law. They shouldn't be. They're crimes, but they're not crimes because we've created laws in the United States and much of the world that allow this to happen. Soros is one example of that. He's certainly not the only one, and probably not the most powerful one either, although he's certainly got plenty of power.
Absolutely right. John Perkins is our guest. It's great to catch up with you again, John. I'm like a child. When I first started making programs like this back in the late 2000s, you were one of the first people I got on when I was starting to see things a bit differently myself. I've never forgotten it, or reading the book either. JohnPerkins.org is John's website. There's also a terrific TED Talk on YouTube. It's on John's own YouTube channel. Check it out there. It's about 18, 19 minutes long. It's terrific. It's really good, really important. Share it with people who are just starting to see, you know, through the lies and the deception of the media. I don't know if you got this. You probably didn't. You're a busy man. But late in the day today, I sent you an article written for foreignpolicy.com by Jose Cardenas. Now, some of our listeners will know who he is, some won't, but he used to work for the George W. Bush administration. He used to oversee Latin American policy for the George W. Bush administration. I'm not going to swear and use bad language with John on the programme with me, and it's not funny either, but this guy has written an article basically calling for a coup in Venezuela. Now, John, I don't know what you think. I've always been sympathetic... I do know what you think. I've always been sympathetic to the Bolivar movement. I've been sympathetic to Chavez and what he tried to do. And I think Nicolas Maduro, beleaguered though he is, I think he's tried to carry on the policies of Chavez, you know, nationalize the country's resources and use them for the people. He's under enormous pressure now, John. There's no doubt about that. What do you make of openly calling in, you know, a very, very widely read publication, openly calling for a coup? It's in plain sight, John. They're not hiding this stuff anymore.
Yeah, I did get the article, Richie. Thank you for sending it. I It's outrageous to call for a coup of another country. The United States has no right to do these things, and yet, of course, we've done that many times. We've been involved in many coups, including in Venezuela and elsewhere. I think it's a terrible, terrible thing. We have no right to exercise that kind of authority. You get back to even back to the Soros thing, where Soros, I mean Soros, when he established one of his funds in Europe, says, Europe, he talked about Europe needing to wake up and recognize this under attack from Russia.
Yeah,
I was recently in Russia, as you mentioned. Putin's done a lot of bad things. I have no doubt about that. There's been a lot of corruption under his government and so on and so forth. What government hasn't?
Yes.
But I think that the Russians very much see that they are under attack from NATO, the United States, and Europe. You know, Putin has gone on record of saying NATO was created to counter the Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw Pact doesn't exist anymore. Why is there a NATO? So there's always two sides to these stories. And I think as we look at Venezuela, we can see that too. I'm no fan of Maduro. I think Maduro's made horrible mistakes. He is no Chavez. Chavez, despite whatever went wrong in that country at the time economically, Chavez was very charismatic. He had the voice of the people. He had the heart of the people. Maduro doesn't seem to have that same ability, that same charisma.
No charisma.
I'm not sure what Maduro is doing. Venezuela is a mess. There's no question. But for the United States, for anybody in the United States to suggest that somehow we have the right to decide what's right for Venezuela, that's a crime. We don't have that right, and we need to stay out. And certainly every other Latin American country would agree with that policy. And what we're talking about doing is what we tried to do in Cuba, which was overthrow a government there. And we never did it successfully, and as a result, it caused tremendous hatred toward us from many Latin American countries and African countries and Asian countries around the world who saw this bullying by the American government. It's what's being threatened again in Venezuela, and I think it's absolutely despicable.
Yeah, it's outrageous. It absolutely is right. Do you think that I agree with you in terms of the charisma of Maduro or the lack of it? Chavez did well in meeting with Rousseff and so many South American leaders that want, and nobody knows more about this than you, of course, to create an alliance to kind of fight back against the imperialist tactics of the US and the US's allies. Do you think that, the United States, its allies, the UK, Israel and other countries, Saudi Arabia, they were able to manipulate the markets to make things very, very difficult for those countries? I think that's one of the things that they find very difficult to counter, John.
Well, yes, and it's not just manipulating the markets. It's been something much more outright there. So I can speak much more specifically about Ecuador, for example. Ecuador had an elected president, Rafael Correa, who had an MBA and a PhD in economics, an MBA from a Belgian college, a PhD from a U.S. university, extremely well knowledgeable in economics. And he was taking a very strong stance of making sure that the oil companies stayed out of the Amazon regions of Ecuador and that they paid a fair share of their profits to the Ecuadorian people. There was a tremendous pressure put on him to change. I know economic hitmen went down to try to pressure him. And then the President Zelaya of Honduras, who was a friend of Correa's and was instituting incredible social reforms there, wanted to almost double the extremely low wage rate and keep foreign companies from owning huge amounts of land, which was a huge threat to Dole and Chiquita and other U.S. corporations. Pressure was put on him by economic hitmen. It failed. So he was overthrown in a coup and replaced by a terrible set of dictators that still run Honduras, and it's probably the most dangerous country in the hemisphere, maybe in the world outside of absolute total war zones like Iraq and Afghanistan. And Correa watched this and felt threatened by it. And then there was a coup launched against him. But it was a coup that was intended to fail because I have no doubt the CIA was involved. But they used the chief of police of Quito, and the army stood behind Correa. Well, the CIA very well knows that no coup in Latin America ever succeeds unless the army's behind it, the local army. They weren't in this case. So I think the coup was an attempt to keep Correa in power because he was a very strong president, but also to send a huge warning, a shot across the bow. And that attempted coup that he survived because the army stood behind him, and what happened just a few months before that in Honduras, convinced Correa to totally modify his position. And suddenly he opens the Amazon up to the oil companies. He doesn't pressure them nearly as hard as he did before to share profits. He totally changed his views and stayed in power through his elected terms. So, you know, in addition to all the economic pressure we put on these countries, leaders in Latin America know that they are vulnerable to coups, that they are vulnerable to assassination. And so we have seen in recent years a very strong turn toward the right in Latin America. It had gone more and more democratic, especially after Chavez was able to withstand the CIA coup against him earlier in the earlier in this century. And because he withstood that coup under the Bush administration and saw that the U.S. was basically kind of a paper tiger once he overcame the coup, then suddenly we had movements throughout 10 countries in Latin America that moved more toward progressive governments and democracy. And now that's changing. It's going back to the right because, let's say, the U.S., its allies in Britain and NATO have exerted all kinds of pressure on these governments, including things like with Dilma and Lula, these corruption charges. Probably has been some corruption. There's tremendous corruption in Brazil. There's tremendous corruption in our government in the United States. We know that. But that doesn't mean governments should get overthrown in that way. You deal with it on other levels. We've seen this consistently in Latin America, an attack on democracy in Latin America.
John Perkins is our guest. We've got John for another 10 minutes or thereabouts. Go to johnperkins.org. If you haven't read Confessions of an Economic Hitman or the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I recommend you read them. If you have, check out a copy of it and pass it on to somebody who hasn't, because it's really important stuff, this. And it's a great way of introducing people to, you know, what's really going on. One of the things I've never asked you in the times we've talked, we talked on TV, London, we talked on radio over the years. You've travelled everywhere in the world, and I've often wondered, are we kind of doomed in the West, in the kind of Northern Hemisphere West, because of our perceived success, because of our addiction to materialistic things? We are. We've become selfish and we've become narcissistic. And what's amazing is, whenever I read, because I read your blog all the time, I read about you, I see the videos on YouTube. When you travel around the world, especially in the subcontinent, especially in Central and South America, Indonesia, people have food and they have a roof over their heads, but they're not materialistic, they're not selfish, and they don't seem to have narcissism. They seem to be more community spirited. I suppose, in a roundabout way, I'm saying, we're screwed here. Maybe we'd all be better off decamping to these parts of the world to learn a bit about how not to be selfish and how to do things for one another. It's that life economy, John, the term that you coined, moving away from a death economy to a life economy. Are people in these places in the world, are they better than us, John? Spiritually better?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to generalize. If you take, I think if you take traditional cultures in these countries, indigenous cultures as they are traditionally, yes, absolutely, they do practice something that I call a life economy, which is itself a renewable resource, so that you're constantly aware that everything you do has to be renewable. That's the tradition we all come from. Every one of us comes from one of those types of cultures if we go back far enough. However, in Latin America and so much other parts of the world, these indigenous cultures are being destroyed, in essence, by our educational systems, by missionaries, by our own attitudes. But I think we can learn from them, and why I continue.
All right, we've just lost John momentarily there. His sound has gone down, so I'm just going to give him a quick call back, just to see can we do that. He dropped out there. It might be he's in an area where the coverage maybe dropped out momentarily. Just calling him back. Hopefully we'll be able to reconnect ASAP. It's 12 minutes to the top of the hour. By the way, it's the Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2 here in the UK. Triggerwarning.tv And, of course, richieallen.co.uk. And I am struggling to get back with John there. I'm going to try him one more time. If I can't reach him, I'll take it for... And he's back. Sorry, John, you dropped out momentarily. My apologies.
Sorry. Where was I?
Yeah, you were talking about what we can learn from these indigenous cultures, because obviously I said, you know, are these people better than us, the death economy versus the life economy?
So I think the traditional way of they worked, and that's been changed a lot through by being educated into our system, but the traditional type of economic system that indigenous people have, and we all come from indigenous backgrounds, is a life economic system, an economic system where they realize that whatever they do has to be sustainable. You have to provide for future generations. And we've reached an economic system that I call a death economy that is basically consuming all the resources that it needs, over-consuming them. It's consuming itself into extinction. We need to move into a life economy, an economic system that pays people to, instead of making war or instead of making equipment that drills for more resources, that digs up the earth, cleans up the environment, cleans up pollution, regenerates destroyed environments, and creates new technologies that recycle and that use the sun even more much more efficiently than we're using it today, and the wind and the air and so on and so forth. There's a huge opportunity here, Richie. We don't have to move back into living the way indigenous people lived in terms of our lifestyles, but what we do need to do is understand that we can create an economic system that is itself a renewable resource, and in doing so, we create a lot of jobs for people. We create good living conditions for people. We don't emphasize the extreme materialism of ripping up the earth. We do emphasize more of the spirituality and the pleasure that we get out of playing a role as part of this living planet, rather than as looking at ourselves as outside the living planet, and it's something to be exploited and used up.
Really good stuff, John. I saw you the other day when that story broke here about a whale being found with 80 plastic bags, grocery bags, in its stomach. And I know you've talked so much over the years about the environment. And you think how needless that is, how absolutely stupid and how foolish that is, and the consequences that it probably will have for the next generation and the generation after. But I also thought at the same time, fair play to the media. You know, we bash the media all the time for what it doesn't cover. But when it covers stuff like this, I think, well, that's good stuff, that. Because if you can't get angry about something like that, you'll never get angry, right?
I agree. And, you know, one of the things I push for in the United States is to switch our tax dollars. Instead of paying Raytheon and General Dynamics and these companies to make military equipment to kill people, let's pay them to make equipment that'll clean up that plastic, that'll mine the plastic that's in the ocean so the whales won't be eating it, and we'll reuse it. And also equipment that will clean up all the oil that's spilled around every oil site in the world, including gas stations throughout Europe and the United States and areas where oil has been drilled. I mean, there's a huge opportunity here to understand that taxes are investments. Let's invest them in things that are pro-life instead of against life.
Brilliant. Hey, listen, just before we part company today, great to have you back on. Just about meeting Putin, I'm glad you said about the corruption, because when I bring it up, I get hammered for it. Because obviously, I say obviously, but anybody who's ever known my programme will know that I would support Putin's support of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's my opinion, he's doing the right thing there. But it doesn't negate some of the corruption. I mean, I reported extensively on the Sochi Winter Olympics several years ago when it was a money grab fest by Putin and his cronies. He's no angel either. But he seems to be at the moment, John, standing in the way. He seems to be the only stumbling block in the way of absolute capitulation in the Middle East. What sense of him and the people around him did you get when you were in Russia last year?
Well, I get the sense that the Russian people are afraid of the United States. They say, we won the Cold War, hands down, destroyed the Soviet Union. And after that, the United States and its NATO allies, wherever they found oil or gas, they took it, either legitimately or through wars. And Russia has a lot of oil and gas. So what I kept hearing is that they see Syria as being a gateway into Iran, and Iran is a gateway into Russia. They truly fear NATO and the United States as moving on Russia. And I think, you know, Putin, when I was there in St. Petersburg with him this last fall, he made the point very strongly that he does not support Assad. What he supports is stability. And right now he sees Assad as the only person that can keep stability. He says a little bit like what happened when Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya. Libya fell apart. And the same with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Both of those countries are worse off without those leaders. And that's not to say that they were great leaders, but that the countries are much worse off today. And that's the point that Putin makes. Putin's done a lot of bad things, no question about it. What I liked when he was in St. Petersburg and I was there, one of the things he said is, listen, you know, there's this struggle between the NATO and the U.S. and Russia. It goes on. But he said, what we've all got to recognize is there's five big problems that face all of us all over the world. And that's climate change, income inequality, the threat of nuclear holocaust, cybersecurity, and terrorism. He said, let's all come together to confront those. That's a perception change. I think it's important for people to make a perception change. After you make a perception change, you get action changes. And I think I applaud Putin for making that perception change. I certainly don't applaud a lot of the actions he actually takes. But I think it's a little bit like when we talk about corporations greenwashing and becoming green because it's good for their promotion. But at the same time, when a company does that, something begins to change within them, a perception changes, and that over time will lead to changes in reality. Changes in perception create changes in reality.
Brilliant. We all remember Ray. Was it Ray Anderson of Interfaith? Was it Ray who changed that company? Yeah. Unbelievable, right. Man. Somebody I would have loved to have got on this program. This is the absolute final question. We've got 90 seconds. I've been asked to put this to you. There's a lot of very upset people. There's a lot of negative energy around among those who believed the things said by the candidate, Donald J. Trump, in the run-up to the 2016 election. He said all the right things, John, didn't he? You know, we're going to stop this interventionism overseas. No more should the US be the world's policeman. No more wars and all of that sort of stuff. We've gotten more of the same. Do you think that might be a good thing, that so many people bought into him and they believe the policies that he said he would implement? Is it a good thing that, you know, maybe more people will wake up that this can't work at the ballot box with these guys? We can't change things through going to vote every 4 years. One of these, you know, candidates who tells all these stories, all these lies. What do you think of Trump, the people who voted for them, how they're feeling now?
Well, I think that the great gift that Trump has given us in the United States and, in fact, the world is to show the shadow side of the United States, that we can't be trusted from what our administration says, and that there's this deep, deep shadow side in the United States, which is rather isolationist, very nationalistic, racist, sexist, and it's coming clear. It's been there for a long time in the shadows, lurking beneath the surface. It's now being exposed to the light. And I think people in the United States are really waking up to that. I don't know whether they'll wake up fast enough to change things in the next election. We'll see. And I think people around the world are seeing this. They're seeing that we're not trustworthy. And I think that's a gift. I think that's a good thing. I think it's good that we all recognize this. I'm a very, very loyal American. And I'm very disturbed at this deep shadow side that's been lurking there for some time. And I'm disturbed by a lot of what's going on today, but I also think it's good that the shadow side is being exposed. It's, you know, the only way that you get rid of your shadow is to expose it and shine a light on it.
Brilliant. Yeah, and as you travel around the world, of course, it becomes easier for you to explain to people what's happening. Folks, go to johnperkins.org. John's books are there. A lot of interesting stuff on the website as well, his blog, and links to the TED Talk I mentioned earlier on. Check out Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the updated new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Hoodwinked is on there as well. My friend, let's not leave it as long before you come back. It's been a pleasure to have you back on the program, John. Thanks for your time, and Godspeed to you.
You're welcome, Richie. Thank you. Thanks for all you do to spread light on the shadows.
On the shadows.
Really, I look forward to the next time.
Thanks, John. It's an honor. Take care. Bye for now. John Perkins live on the line to us from Seattle there. Great to have him back on the program. It's 90 seconds to the top of the hour. We're going to take, yeah, we are, a wee break. When I come back, I'll read some comments. And don't forget, Paul Craig Roberts, the former US Assistant Treasury Secretary, joins the programme. Paul joins me in a few minutes' time. It's Thursday's programme. It's the 7th of June, Thursday, June 7th, 2018.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today. Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Welcome back. I've had an email from somebody who said, Richie, why didn't you challenge John on climate change? I've had conversations with John in the past about climate change. I don't believe that man, in terms of man's activities, man's industrial activities today, I do not believe are changing the climate. I don't believe that for a minute. John knows that. I didn't have time to get into it with him, and I don't go in for a little point scoring, you know. I don't believe in climate change. Maybe you don't either. The environmental impact of our activity, that's a different thing entirely. And on that, I agree with John totally. Doesn't mean that the planet is being destroyed irreparably, but it's causing catastrophic problems for the next generation and the generation after. That's pollution we're talking about there. That's why I brought up the plastic bags and stuff like that. Right. 2 minutes past the hour then. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Hi to Bass Ninja there, to Tiger, to David Stanford. How you doing, David? No wonder the West wants rid of Putin, Richie. He's against all the tools of their tax and controls by the sounds of it. I want to say hi to Dub Love as well. Presumably that's Dublin Love, as in loving Dublin, the capital city of my country. Hi to Cartoon Drunk as well. Wales should reuse their 10p bags for life when they shop at Tesco's for plankton. Maybe. Right. Don't know what to make of that. But good stuff. Out to Faisal as well, to Sean McDonald. Sean tweets, bigger picture, petrodollar is dead and the elite are moving on to the next energy supply that they control. A free energy they have found out how to exploit. Of course, we've talked at length about that over the years, about Tesla's theories and the extraction of free energy from the atmosphere, which I absolutely believe is very simple to do, even though I can't explain how to do it. But I'm sure that it is very possible. But of course, every energy company, every big oil company in the world, I suppose they'll do everything in their power to prevent us ever having free energy. Where's the fun in that? Eh? Hi to Spirit Samba as well, who said that one of the best books he's read is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Right. I fancy a bit of Madonna. Now, there's no good reason for that. But it's the sort of weather we're having, right? When I was a younger man, a much younger man, when I was working on radio, late night radio, I kind of developed a taste, well, for every type of music known to man or woman. And I've always liked this. This is borderline from Madonna. When we come back, hopefully, if there are no gremlins in the system, the great Paul Craig Roberts will join me. We'll talk about Israel, Iran, and more besides with PCR himself. After Madge. From Madonna on the Richie Allen Show, 6.5 minutes past the hour, Thursday's programme, the 6th of June, it's the 7th of June, it's the 7th of June, 2018, broadcasting across the UK on Fab Radio. We're on TuneIn to richieallen.co.uk, trigger warning, Europe's most listened to independent radio show, that's official, thanks for making it so. Well, to say that we love our next guest is an understatement. He's an amazing man. He's an economist and author, of course, of books like The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism, How America Was Lost, many others as well. Check out paulcraigroberts.org. That's his website. And, of course, he is most well known, I suppose, for being a one-time US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Great guy, and we love that he gives us his time. Mr. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks, Richie. Well, we made it by the skin of our teeth. The internet was out, and they fixed it 2 minutes before you called.
Yeah, you've had a few issues with internet. We've had some around here as well, locally. They're trying to upgrade everybody to this super speed, 300 meg speed or whatever it is. That's the problem. I thought of you on Tuesday. I was at the Rolling Stones in Manchester on Tuesday, Mick Jagger. And I thought of you, because somebody said to me, isn't Jagger great jumping around the stage at 74? And I said, he hasn't met Paul Craig Roberts, who's the multitasker extraordinaire. Great to have you back on. I'm going to ask you straight up. Back in the late winter, you were very concerned that circumstances were conspiring to possibly push us to the brink of a nuclear conflict. You wrote about it on paulcraigroberts.org. You made some very good points, and you know, you had some good reasons for thinking that. At the time, people said, because of your experience and because of who you are, people said, wow, Paul is basically saying that, you know, we're looking at World War III. Do you still feel we're close to a conflict like that, or have things occurred recently to maybe give you a moment of pause? What do you think?
Well, I think we've lucked out, because, you know, the real danger was the last fake chemical attack in Syria. The real danger was that the Trump regime was going to attack and hit Russian forces as well as Syrian. And that would have forced Putin into a war situation, which he very diplomatically avoids. But the U.S. military got on the phone with the Russian military, and they worked out that fake attack that didn't actually do any real damage anywhere, but let the Trump regime save face. So that showed that the two militaries were able to work this out despite the politician in the White House. So that was a big relief. I have been concerned still that President Putin's willingness to accept so many provocations and so many insults in order to avoid conflict, but that this acceptance of them encourages them from Washington, because Washington reads that as a lack of nerve on the part of Putin and the Russians. And so it encourages Washington to get more extreme in its provocations. And so I remained concerned that just the extremity of the provocations would eventually force the war. Now, however, I am further reassured because of Trump's ability to alienate all of Washington's European vassal states with this pulling out of the Iranian agreement and now threatening all of Europe with sanctions. Equivalent to those he says he's going to add to Iran, so that you now have the Europeans reassessing their close cooperation with Washington, because it's becoming just too costly. We've seen the statements by Merkel in Germany, which I thought was surprising, that they can't trust the Americans anymore. We saw the statements by Juncker, the head of the EU, who says that it's time to stop fussing at Russia and to make friends, and that Europe has to find its own way independently of the Americans. So if we see the empire breaking up under Trump's economic assault. You know, he's even threatened Germany.
Yeah, who hasn't he threatened?
Yeah, if they go ahead with that Nord 2 gas pipeline, he's threatened Germany with all kinds of sanctions. So this sort of shows that Putin's bet seems to be paying off. You know, his bet was, I'll just sit here, accept the insults, accept the provocations, and sooner or later, Washington will ruin itself for the Europeans. And when it ruins itself for the Europeans, it'll lose its forward bases, the NATO thing. All of this can come unwound, and we can avoid a conflict, because without Europe, Washington really can't produce the kinds of conflict arrangements that it's been trying to produce with Russia. So I am more relieved. It's still dangerous because the neoconservatives still control Washington. They still control the security agencies. They still control the Trump White House. You know, one of the most notorious ones is the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley. But even here, I'm encouraged because I saw her effort to get some sort of an American proposed resolution through that essentially gives Israel free hand to slaughter the Palestinians, didn't get a single vote.
Not one.
Except hers.
Except her own, yeah.
So again, it's sort of an indication that the world maybe has had enough of American bullying. And it may well be that the way Trump causes normalization of relations with Russia is by inadvertently breaking up the American empire.
Yeah. But let me put this to you. This is really good stuff, this, because I've been thinking, obviously, I've been reading. Paul's written about this extensively lately. Go to paulcraigroberts.org and read his articles. What if, now hear me out now before you jump straight down my throat, but what if, right? What if the European Union is the big bogeyman here? Putin was on Austrian television the other day. I thought it very interesting. And he said that terrorism is, you know, we got to fight terrorism. And I'd like to be part of some European security arrangement, some sort of agreement. What if the European Union, which of course has become ever more seeking more and more political and financial union to become this big super state, what if that's his real enemy? You know where I'm going with this? What if Putin is, his real danger is not the neocon, you know, Jewish supremacist controlled White House, but the growth of the fascist superstate that is the European Union? What do you think, Paul?
Well, that's an interesting idea, Richie, and it could develop that way. On the other hand, I doubt that the European Union would ever be able to produce the kinds of military armaments and armies that would be of any consequence to Russia. I think also just the general area of Europe is too small. And I think also, don't we see indications that the EU itself is having trouble? For example, Italy now has elected two anti-establishment parties, and they now control the legislature and have the right to form the government. The establishment president, I think, spent about 3 months trying to block that, but hasn't been successful. So we see then the rise of anti-establishment political parties in Italy. So it kind of looked, and we see other statements in from Eastern Europe, Eastern European members of the EU that show they're very unhappy. For example, the Austrian president, Orban in Hungary, these people are not speaking the EU language. So that you see a rising dissatisfaction within the EU itself. Now, I have always understood that the EU itself was a CIA creation, in the sense that the CIA wanted a unified Europe because it's easier to control the EU than to control all the independent countries. And, you know, the United States was very much frustrated by Charles de Gaulle unwillingness to join NATO or to follow American direction. And in fact, a number of people believe that the various assassination attempts on de Gaulle that were blamed on the Algerian, the French army that had been fighting in Algeria to keep control of the colony, blaming them because de Gaulle left that war and turned Algeria over to Algerians, A lot of people think actually these were CIA attempts because he wouldn't join NATO, he wouldn't cooperate with Washington. So it's entirely possible that the EU itself is going to come apart. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And the way it's worked in recent years, and you know, we've discussed this on your program, essentially the EU plundered Greece, plundered Portugal.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and more or less intimidated Spain. I don't know if they got to the plunder part or not, but they certainly got the government changed. And we know that the previous effort in Italy was frustrated by the EU that
the finance minister.
They appointed all the ministers of the government. They appointed the prime minister. The guy was a Goldman Sachs banker.
Absolutely.
Part of Italy. So this shows the kinds of dissatisfaction with the EU. And I think all of the immigration, all the people fleeing Washington's wars, plus everybody who used that to join in, to be an immigrant too. And these wars were supported by the Europeans. So now they all this immigration and all the problems from that. And so it may well be that the EU is just not going to hang together, that the interests are too diverse. And what it really implies is the subordination of the Southern Europeans to the Northern ones. And if they're not willing to have that subordination, then the EU can break apart. It also means that the Eastern Europeans have to be subordinate to the Western. But their alternative is Russia. So I think we could enter a more hopeful era. What the Israelis and the neoconservatives in Washington will do, though, that we don't know, because it's still the case that the Israelis want to be rid of Syria and Iran, because Syria and Iran supply Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is the defense of southern Lebanon from Israel. And Israel wants to occupy southern Lebanon for various reasons, and one of the most important is the water resources. So the Israelis are used to prevailing. They're used to using Washington to fight their wars. They've been doing it for 17 years, if not longer. And these people don't quit easily. And the neoconservatives are very much dedicated to their ideology of American hegemony. They don't want to give that up. And then you have all the various kinds of economic interests in Washington, represented in Washington, you know, the big American banks, they like the financial hegemony. They want to keep that. The oil companies like to be able to control the location of pipelines and the flows. I think they're less interested in owning them than they are in controlling the flows of oil and the location of the pipeline. So all those interests are still alive. And they're not going to just go away and quit. But I do think it's more hopeful now. But of course, all of this European criticism of Trump and the talk about trade wars and all of that, that could just be the Europeans posturing for more money. Because as we've also discussed on your show, the United States has a long tradition of purchasing European political leader. you know, as I've told you before, my dissertation chairman, who ended up in a very powerful position in the government, told me that when I asked him, how is it we get other countries to always do what we want? He said, money. I said, oh, you mean foreign aid? He says, no, bagfuls of money. We give their leaders bagfuls of money. We own them. They report to us. So, and of course, the same is true of the media. We know that from the book that Udo Ulfalki wrote.
That's German, right, the German, yeah. Amazing book.
That there's no significant journalist in Europe that's not on the CIA payroll. Now, he's got no reason to make that up. I mean, it didn't do him any good to say that.
No, to say the least.
And so these kinds of connections are strong. And I don't, you know, the notion that they're just going to completely unravel suddenly and go away. But I think they're certainly under stress. And I think Trump, being a bully and blusterer, he kind of fits in with the belligerence of the neoconservatives. And he seems to be comfortable with them. So they are probably stronger in Washington than they've been since George W. Bush, when they ran the whole show. But they've made this comeback despite all the failures of their wars in the Middle East. But on the other hand, I think Putin's diplomacy, his patience, his restraint, I think the Europeans are finding him more reassuring than Washington. So if the Europeans would actually tend to their own interests rather than Washington's and start representing European peoples instead of whoever's in the White House, which is all they've done for 75 years, All the European politicians have done for 75 years is kowtow to Washington.
Except De Gaulle. Which in turn kowtows to Israel's interests. On the European Union, by the way, Paul has written about this this week. In fact, in the last day or two, democracy is fighting to survive the rise of Western authoritarianism. Go to paulcraigroberts.org and read it. I've seen countries, Paul, in the last 15 years try to get away from the European Union. Twice my own country, the Republic of Ireland, voted no to the Lisbon and Nice treaties. Then we were sent back. The Danes tried to leave, were sent back. The French voted against a referendum. They were sent back. We all thought, well, I didn't think. It was one of the few things I got right. But back in 2014 when Alexis Tsipras took Syriza into power in Greece and he seemed to be anti-European, I predicted that he would capitulate and that Greece would be worse off than it was. It turned out that I was right. We've seen, as you mentioned yourself, the government, the new government in Italy, they wanted Paolo Savona, who's actually against the single currency. They wanted him to be finance minister. The European Union said no and the parties acquiesced. And you probably know this, because you've got your eyes on what's happening in the UK. But our decision to leave the European Union, taken in 2016, that's just been laughed at and been thrown out the window. Today we learned that we're going to be in the European Union till about 2022, at the very least, whether we like it or not. Paul, you're familiar, of course, with the music of the Eagles. You can check out any time you like, Paul, but you can never leave. It's a it's a fascist dictatorship, isn't it? It survives and survives and survives, despite the fact that right across, as you have so properly stated, right across Southern Europe and the Republic of Ireland, which has been destroyed economically by membership of the European Union, despite all of this rebellion, all this revolt by ordinary people like me and you and our listeners against it, it doesn't matter. It marches on, the European Union.
Yes, it does. It marches on, but we see stronger and stronger resistance. And I think this vote in Italy, where the establishment simply lost control.
Yeah.
And the reason the two parties had to accept the compromise finance minister was that the president of Italy
was able, using, I think, probably inappropriately, powers of the presidency to actually prevent them from forming the government that they had a right to from the election. So I think the whole formation of the government was delayed at least for 3 months. And so that's I can right. see the parties would say, look, let's just go ahead and get this thing going so that we ourselves don't lose the people's confidence.
They shouldn't have done that. Am I right? Am I right to say they should not have done that? They should have told the EU where to go off a cliff. Come on, Paul. You can't bow down to these tyrants.
I agree. I have the same response to it that you do, Richie. On the other hand, I can see that the delay in being able to form a government can be used against the new parties by the establishment, pointing out, well, look, you voted for them 3 months ago and they still haven't got a government. And so I think they were rightfully concerned, maybe too concerned, but it's right to have some concern that they would lose the confidence of people if they couldn't form a government. And most people believe that some kind of compromise is okay. So as long as they didn't give away the election.
Yeah, I hear you.
But it would be hard for Italy alone to pull out of the EU. It needs to be something that several countries do together, because it's harder to gang up on several than one. You know, the big banks in the United States, Germany, Holland, they could smash the Italian currency without any trouble.
That's a good point, Paul. Can I just, I don't like interrupting you, but let me just jump in there. That's a hugely important point you're making there. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who's a very good writer for the Telegraph newspaper, he absolutely endorses what you said. He said, if the Italians or the Greeks reintroduce their historic currency, devalued it, you know, which would be the right thing to do. He said what you said. He said with basically they'd be destroyed by the European Central Bank, the IMF, and they wouldn't have security in numbers. They wouldn't have Spain on their side or Portugal or the Republic of Ireland. It's a very good point, that. Because people always ask me that. Why don't they devalue their own currency, get rid of the euro, and tell the European Union to take a running jump, because they would be attacked unmercifully?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, most likely the Bank of Tokyo, because the Japanese answer to Washington, just like the Germans do, or have been. they would just all step in and short the currency and drive it down to zero. They would just short it. And, you know, look, remember what one person, George Soros, did to the British pound.
Remember that?
That was years ago, and England was even stronger then. And so if one person could do that to a reserve currency, because the pound was a reserve currency, still is to some extent. You can see what powerful central banks could do to countries of very light financial weight, like Greece and Italy and Portugal and Spain. They would be massacred. So, and they would be.
Yeah, they would.
And they
yeah.
know it.
They know it, yeah. Yeah, because when I was covering Greece, I had Greek journalists on, and we talked about that. You know, I had people on from Katharimeni, the English newspaper in Greece, and we were talking about what the Greeks really needed to do. And then Tsipras told the Greeks to reject the bailout terms. The Greeks did, and then he sold them down the river. There is, I know you know this, but you are in the States. There is absolute disillusion, Paul, particularly in the United Kingdom, as Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, seems to be, well, it isn't seems to be, she is capitulating to the European Union. Instead of walking away and maybe going to World Trade Organization terms for trading and tell these guys, you know, to take a running jump. But again, you've suggested there that even the UK, even with its own currency, could suffer if they were to do that, if they were to say, no deal whatsoever, we leave now and we do whatever we want. You probably reckon, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, that the repercussions, the recriminations from Brussels might be devastating in the short term anyway for the UK.
Or from Washington.
Or from Washington, right.
Yeah, because, you know, we've made it clear that we don't approve of the UK leaving the EU. And so, you know, as we discussed long ago, I don't expect that Brexit will happen. And certainly the Bank of England knows that if the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank come after the pound, that it can't do anything about it. So, you know, the price of Brexit, it has to be known in British ruling circles, will be an attack on the pound. And the whole effort will be to convince the British it was a mistake so that the decision is reversed.
Yeah.
So what this shows is the kind of fascism you mentioned earlier. And I would put it slightly different. I would say that what it shows is that no European country is independent. There are things that they simply can't do, even though they're sovereign, because they'll be punished for it if they do it. And so there are very limited ways in which any European country can express its sovereignty. And this sovereignty is gradually disappearing within the EU. And this is why I am happy to see fissures in the EU. The Italian vote, the statements that come out of Austria, come out of Hungary, elsewhere.
Spain, yeah.
The thing may fail. And I think if Europe breaks from Washington, which they should do in the interest of their own survival, because if Europe stays united with Washington, Washington is eventually going to succeed in forcing Russia into a war. And of course, Europe would be the first to disappear. And there's no bringing it back.
No, no.
So if the Europeans were aware of the danger of the situation of being America's ally when the United States is hell-bent to reduce the sovereignty of a powerful country like Russia, they're asking for their own destruction. So they should break and tend to their own interest and make whatever deals serve them best with the Russians, with the Americans, with whoever, but cease being vassal states of Washington. And there are many reasons they did that. There was the Soviet threat, which was always overblown. They got a free ride in their defense budgets. They got a free ride in trade with Washington. They got a free ride in using whatever mechanisms Washington put in place. They didn't have to do the development. They didn't have to have the expense. So it was easy for politicians, because it reduced pressures on their budgets to have the Americans paying and doing these things. So you can see what happened. But now the cost is coming home, and I think that they have an incentive to go their own way. And I think even if this Italian revolt gets put down like the Greek one, and the Hungarian one is put down, you know, we're trying to overthrow this guy in Hungary. I mean, I think you know that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so if we overthrow him, but there's still clearly
cracks.
Dissatisfaction.
Yeah. Fishers, you call them. There's fishers appearing. I want to ask you this just before, because we're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes. Since we last spoke, Bashar al-Assad gave a very good interview to Russia Today, the first in-depth interview that he'd given for about 6 months. And he seemed to be in good spirits and good form. Obviously, they've driven the jihadists pretty much out of, well, they've gone from Damascus. They've reclaimed so much of Syria. And I think they're hiding in Idlib now, I think, or somewhere in that region. It looks like the attempt to overthrow Syria using these Western-backed lunatics is failing. So the final question for you this evening, and thanks again, Paul, for giving us your time. You know how much I appreciate it. The question is, what are the Zionists and the neocons likely to do now that unleashing the head-chopping lunatics hasn't succeeded? What's the next step?
Well, I think what, the United States is occupying part of that territory. And we now have troops there. And I think we got France to put some troops there. So I think what they were hoping to do was to have another false flag attack that would justify an attack on Syria by the United States and Israel. And the Russian sort of timidity, allowing Israel to attack Syria, was encouraging that. So, but I think what has stopped that is the other fake things have blown up in their face, you know, like the alleged assassination by Russia of the journalist in Ukraine. You know about that, right?
Yeah.
And that's blown up on them. He wasn't assassinated. They told a lie, and they told another lie about why they told it. We have this whole thing about the guy in Salisbury, England, which allegedly poisoned by. That's blown up.
Yeah,
The last false flag, a chemical attack in Syria, what was it, Douma? That's blown up. There wasn't any attack at all. It was all made up, fake news. So now it's kind of hard to pull off another fake news because people are going to be more suspicious, and it's probably going to get branded another false flag attack. So I don't know what they're going to do, but I don't think they're going to quit.
They won't quit. Here's one for you, Paul, just briefly. What about another manipulated global financial meltdown? That's always, that's a tool they love, you know, cause chaos by crashing the markets everywhere. What do you think? Causing huge problems for people's individual savings and all of that, houses. What do you think?
Well, that's dangerous to them too. See, it's not just dangerous to people in the market and ordinary people, but it's dangerous to them too, because the whole dollar-based global system now is so endangered. It's such a house of cards. Everything is based on endless creation of money and misreporting of inflation, misreporting of employment. A crash now, probably they'd lose control. Unemployment would be high. There'd be problems. There'd be political problems. There'd be more support for non-establishment parties like Marine Le Pen. You would see these kinds of developments. I don't think they want that. In fact, I think they're doing all they can. I don't think it would work for them.
So you don't see that as an immediate danger then? Because a lot of our listeners...
It may happen because they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the conditions for it to fall apart are there. And they keep it together with money. You know, if we're not printing the money, the Japanese are, or the European Central Bank is. Someone's always, as long as it's liquidity from central banks going into the financial markets, the prices stay up. So they're doing everything they can to keep, you know, all the glue and the strings holding things together still attached.
They have used those crashes in the past, though, to grab what we call real wealth, haven't they? Land and utilities and everything. It's something they've done. And then, of course, they bring austerity in then to pay for it, which is even worse for people. Keeps us dumbed down. Yeah.
They tend to do that to other countries.
To other countries, yeah. But we've had it here. We've had it in this country and in the Republic of Ireland. We're just about out of time for today. You and I, please God, will talk again real soon. It's summertime now, and I know with the grandchildren and everything, you probably have plans for the summer, so I don't know whether to leave you alone for a couple of months or to give you a shout next month. How are you fixed?
I'm always willing to talk to you, and I'm always working. And so anytime so inclined, just give me an email. We'll arrange it.
Of course I will. I told you earlier, Mick Jagger's got nothing on you, the Rolling Stones. These guys think they work hard. Nobody works harder than Paul. Folks, you've just been listening to the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and the author and journalist, Paul Craig Roberts. His website, bookmark it, put it on your menu bar, is paulcraigroberts.org. Regular articles from Paul and guests challenging the official narrative, challenging the BS that we're fed on a daily basis by the mainstream media. Paul, thanks so much again for your time today. I really appreciate it, and we'll do it again real soon. Thanks a lot.
I look forward to it, Richie.
Cheers, my friend. Bye for now. The great Paul Craig Roberts, live on the line to us there from Virginia today. Great to have him on. It's a quarter to the top of the hour. Quick break, back in a minute with plenty more.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Good to be with you. Let me tell you something that hasn't really annoyed me, but you're going to think that it annoyed me. It didn't annoy me. But just to give you an idea of sometimes how selfish people can be. This program came on air in September of 2014, right? Now, I haven't got the exact number, but I've broadcast every year between then and now an average of around 230 to 250 live shows. That's radio and television shows and what have you. And I went to the Rolling Stones on Tuesday. I was given a present of the tickets. We spend a lot of time, Caroline and myself, at rock concerts and pop concerts. We love to do that. It's not because we're rolling in money. It's because we don't have children. We don't smoke and we don't drink very much. So we don't have an awful lot of overheads. Putting on the show is expensive, an expensive thing to do. But Caroline's financially independent. She's got her own job and all of that. But I went to the Stones and somebody who was giving me £2 a month cancelled their donation and complained, saying that you take an awful lot of time off. So I went into the archives and I looked at last year's workload. 245 shows last year. This year, I'm on track to do somewhere in the region of between 230 and 250 live shows. That's live radio shows. That's commercial, national radio standard live radio shows with a full news roundup with clips that have to be edited and with guests and research that have to be done. I do that myself every day. And the fact that somebody would get annoyed because it wasn't on air, even though I'm going to do a live show tomorrow, Friday, to make up for it, and would cancel a £2 a month donation. It's kind of frightening, really, isn't it? What goes through people's minds? Anyway, I'm not going to virtue signal now and talk about, you know, what it is I do, because I don't do anything. The important thing about this programme is the guests that come on, like John Perkins, like Paul, like Kelly Cottam last night, like everybody else. I'm not important. I'm just the guy who puts it together. But putting it together is an enormous undertaking. It really is 16 hours a day. And if you don't believe me, contact my friend Jean-Ann Crowley on Facebook, who has worked for everybody. National radio. She's done it all, Jean-Ann. And Jean-Ann occasionally expresses her incredulity that one bloke on his own with no help whatsoever. And I'm not talking about Simon, who's an amazing guy who does the YouTube uploads. That's incredible. That's important. But in terms of putting the show together, it's just me. And somebody would bitch that I took a Tuesday night off to go to a gig, even though I'm going to do a show to make up for it tomorrow. It's a bit mad, really, isn't it? What goes through people's minds? Anyway, I'm modest to a fault. What I do isn't that important. But the platform is important. Not me, but the platform itself is. And if I can bring my skills to bear on this kind of thing by doing it so professionally, and it is national and commercial radio broadcast standard. It is. That's not bragging. It is. I know, because I've done it nationally and commercially very successfully. So don't bitch about it on the occasion when I go to a rock concert in the summer, you know. Fuck off. And I'm just being reminded by my oft-mentioned friend. It seems that a lot of people who listen to this programme, because of the professionalism of it, they assume that there's a staff. There isn't. There's me. Every morning there's me, Muggins. Half five, start, run with the dog for 25 minutes, come back, shower, and start on this madness. It's a mad undertaking. David Icke used to say it to me time and time again. How do you do it? Mental, Richie, how do you do it? I said, well, I do it because it takes time. It takes hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And I do get to the stage every 12 or 14 weeks where I just collapse. I just collapse completely because it's mental. It's mentally mad to be doing it. But I love it. And I want no praise for it. I want no credit for it. I don't want any emails saying you're the best and all that bollocks. I don't want any of that. But if I take a night off to go to a rock concert, don't fucking cancel a £2 a month donation, you bastard. Ah, it just made me laugh. I said I wasn't annoyed by it, and I'm not. But it just goes to the mindset of people. You know? Crazy, isn't it? Crazy. I will do this year probably 240 live radio shows. No virtue signalling, no credit, no praise. But a little bit of respect for it. Or go and do it yourself and see how you get on. That's all I'm saying, right? Okay. Yeah. By the way, if you do listen to this programme and you've never contributed before, please consider doing so. Go to richieallen.co.uk, PayPal details there, and also bank account details. But if you can't afford it, forget about it. Don't worry about it. You know, I don't beg for donations. I don't plead for them. I very, very rarely mention them. But this programme exists because of you. Without you, without your support, there wouldn't be a Richie Allen Show. Or any other independent radio show either. It's not just me. There are other men and women out there doing good stuff. You know, I ain't the be-all and the end-all of it. There are others as well. And without your support of them, they wouldn't be able to do it. And you wouldn't have a counter-narrative to the bullshit. You wouldn't have Paul Craig Roberts. You wouldn't have John Perkins. You wouldn't have the aforementioned Ike. You wouldn't have, you know, the great men and women who come on this programme. Thank God for shows like this and others. Where else would Emma Ibbitson, where else would Kelly Cottam go to talk to you about forced adoption? They wouldn't have anywhere to go. So don't cry when the occasional night off is taken. Look at the bigger picture. 230 to 250 live shows a year is an extraordinary thing, let me tell you. Anyway, speaking of tomorrow, I'll be with you tomorrow. I'm planning to do 2 hours tomorrow, but it might be 90 minutes, but it's going to be at least 90 minutes at 4 o'clock UK time. However, the reason I'm doing it at 4 UK time is so that I can have Friday night to myself, but I can put it on repeat at 7 o'clock. So if you don't hear it live tomorrow, don't panic. Just rock up to your phone or your tablet or your computer at 7 o'clock and I'll be on with the show that goes out live at 4. So I've invited a couple of guests on. I'll have a roundup of the week's news as well. And there you go. Luke Blackier. That's a lovely name. Luke Blackier. Luke says the £2 guy was an idiot. He probably wasn't an idiot. It's funny, you come to depend. I was a big listener to Jerry Ryan's radio programme. One of the greatest, if not the greatest, in my opinion, talk show host there's ever been on radio, Jerry Ryan. And I used to get pissed off if he wasn't there. In fact, when he went on holiday, I used to count the days till he came back on air. Even though he would have deputies, he would have people sit in for him who were capable of holding together a programme. But when he was missing, it pissed me off. And I understand when you present radio, as I've been doing for a long time, that you get to know people. I get to know you, you get to know me, and you kind of become like a slipper. You become a slipper for me and vice versa. And when you are missing, it cheeses people off. It puts them puts their noses out of joint because they expect you to be. I understand that. But Jesus, look at the bigger picture. You know, I'm going to present an enormous amount of radio shows this year on my own. No editor, no audio editor, no producer, just yours truly. All right? Gene Anna's reminding me that Dave Fanning used to do it for Jerry. He did. I couldn't think of it. I should have remembered. It was Dave Fanning, another great presenter in his own right, used to do it for Jerry. But I wouldn't listen because I loved Jerry Ryan. Loved him. Loved listening to him. I like to think that I learned one or two things from him. Maybe I didn't. I like to think I did. Anyway, that's it for today's programme. Going to leave you with some Stevie Wonder. Join me tomorrow at 4 p.m. UK time. That is 11 a.m. Eastern time in the United States, and it's 8 a.m. Pacific time in the United States, and it's 5 p.m. Central European time. Join me at 4 tomorrow. Might have one or two more bits of music than I normally do, but I will have plenty of news for you. I'll have some interesting things, and I guarantee I'll have an interesting guest, if not two. Massive thanks to PCR. Go to paulcraigroberts.org. John Perkins as well. johnperkins.org. Thanks to Jean Ann for the tidbits of information which are vital to the programme. And Simon Stewart, the top man, who for nothing, because of the YouTube demonetization, for nothing, puts those YouTube videos on air, even though he's got his own job. He stays up till the small hours of the morning to do the YouTube. About time he said thanks to Simon Stewart as well. See you tomorrow at 4, leaving you with this from Stevie. On my bucket list of musicians I want to see before I die, Stevie Wonder, no doubt. Look after yourselves and one another. Thanks for listening to the programme today. RichieAllen.co.uk if you want to make a contribution. See you tomorrow at 4. Bye now.